he started to treat me like an employee. And the tone in which he spoke to me, it was disrespectful. Those emails turned into texts, and those texts turned into phone calls. And I remember sitting in my, I'd come home from the office. I was sitting in my garage. I had just answered the call as I was pulling into my house. And I sat in the garage on my phone for about 30 or so minutes.
Welcome to the Healthy Brand Podcast, and I'm your host, Howie Chan. Each episode, I'll bring you an insightful and inspiring strategist, leader, entrepreneur, and uncover lessons that help you become better at influencing human behavior and build the healthiest brands on the planet. Today, we have Stephen Horahan, the brand master himself, gracing our virtual studios. He is the founder of Brand Master Academy, where he teaches thousands of creatives on brand strategy. He hosts a Brand Master podcast, interviewing legends like Seth Godin and Marty Neumeier. Stephen shares with us his journey of going from a stockbroker to brand master, and he drops lessons about branding along the way. So buckle up and off we go. So today we have the brand master himself, Stephen Horahan, founder of Brand Master Academy and the host of the Brand Master podcast. Now, he's been doing this for a while, so I'm super excited for him to come on to the Healthy Brand podcast. Welcome, Stephen.
Thanks so much, Howie. Thanks for having me. And I'm absolutely delighted to be finally on the Healthy Brand podcast. And I'm sure we'll dig into some interesting stuff.
It'll be good. It'll be good. So you have quite the interesting journey. You started off in economics, right? On your way to become a stockbroker. And then jumping into design, you know, freelance, and then launching Brand Master Academy. I've always, you know, just like me, I've sort of meandered my way through different things. You know, I've always loved people's stories about how they did that. What was maybe in the way? You know, were there any fears that were sort of coming up as you jump from one thing to the other? Just kind of share your thoughts about that.
Yeah, look, it was all very organic. You know, I'd love to give you a story that this was all planned from day one.
Right.
It absolutely wasn't. Do you know what I mean? It was a case of, I don't know which way I'm going, and I deal with one challenge at a time. And it just led me on this organic path. And it wasn't until later on in my life and my business career did I start to actually plan things that were going to happen. So as you said, I started off in economics, and you know, I was a stockbroker. This was and I was cutting my teeth post GFC, and I was sitting beside, you know, millionaire stockbrokers. So, you know, the guy to the right of me had made his millions. The guy in front of me had made his millions. These guys were all just kicking back and relaxing. They knew that the stock market was changing before their eyes. And me there, I was trying to pick up whatever I could. And very quickly, it became obvious that the world of stockbroking, as it once was, that I bought into, was no longer there anymore. People just didn't have the trust in stockbrokers. Low-cost brokers were coming along. And now, like years later, we can see AI and what that's going to do to it. But anyway,
what's GFC, Stephen?
What's GFC? The global financial crisis. This is 2008. The stuff that went down. It gave me an opportunity, and it gave me a crossroads to ask the question, well, you know, if I'm going to go down a different path, which I was kind of, I was pushed into that decision, then what, I get to write the script, you know, what is it that I want to do? And design was something that I was always, you know, I was always artistic. I always played with Photoshop, and I was like, you know, I could do, and I looked into a curriculum on design, and I was like, oh, I'm going to love this. And the millionaire stockbroker that was sitting beside me was going, is there any money in design? And I didn't care. You know, I was going on a different path, and I loved it. I fell in love with design. I was like, waking up in the morning going, I love this stuff. And I was comparing it to the finance world and going, I have made the right decision. But
were you into design before you got into finance? Like, were you in school? Did you go to school for economics,
Stephen? Yes, I did. I went to school. But look, back then it was like, yeah, you know, you choose the path based on, you know, what's a good career.
Yeah, what's a good career? What's a good career?
And so that's what I and I kind of, you know, I loved the Wall Street movies and the idea of being a stockbroker. And, you know, it was...
What'd your parents do, Stephen?
Very, very humble. My dad was a barman. My mom was a waitress. This is Ireland. So humble beginnings, working class upbringing. But they were hard workers, you know, and that's what got instilled in me. That was, that hardworking and those ethics and that's what they gave me. The finance side of things, they didn't push me down that road. The design side of things, they didn't push me down that road. These were all my decisions that I, you know, got better at making over time. The fears in terms of, where I was, every decision came with its own fear. You know, getting out of the stock market and getting into something else. I had built, 8 years of experience in that world, and I was essentially throwing all that away. That was a big decision, leaving a pathway that was going to earn me potentially, a lot of money in comparison to another pathway that was going to give me fulfillment. You know, that was a big decision. Going out on my own, leaving the employment world, that was a big decision.
How'd your parents take that? Moving from the world of finance into design.
Yeah, I remember my mom.
What'd your folks?
I remember my mom was so proud to tell people that I was a stockbroker. And when I told them I was leaving and going into design, I and my mom is never one to overimpose herself or to, you know, and she always gives me a lot of trust in my judgment. But, you know, I could tell that she thought it was a mistake. She didn't tell me, I think you're making a mistake, but that's what I could feel from her. And I know that a few people around me thought it was a mistake as well. But at that point, that was definitely one of the bravest decisions I made to do it. I wouldn't change anything now. You know, it's led me to where I am. I've done some good things up until this point. I've got some more good things on the horizon in front of me. And I'm passionate about the space that I'm in. And at the end of the day, if you have that passion for what you do, you know, you're in a better place than 90% of the people on the planet.
So you mentioned your parents Irish.
Yeah.
Did you grow up in Ireland?
I'm Irish.
Yeah. Did you grow up?
So I'm Irish. I lived in Ireland until I was 20. I left Ireland at 20 to go to Australia to travel. I ended up staying in Australia for 20 years. I met my wife there. After maybe 3 years, she was French. She is French. She didn't speak any English when we met. We were there with like a dictionary for months trying to figure stuff out. She actually made her way in Australia. She got herself a really great corporate job speaking English. But then we moved back to France. So we're living in France now.
You're in France now.
Yeah, France. I'm in the south of France on the border of Spain.
Dude, I still think like you're in Australia for some reason.
I know, everybody does. I should have made some kind of PR announcement that I'm moving because everybody seems to think that I'm still in Australia. So we've been living here for a year and a half now. I'm struggling at the moment trying to grasp the language. So I didn't pick very much of it up being with my wife for the last 17 years, although I should have. My kids have since come over and they're now perfectly fluent. And me, I'm being left on the sidelines, like this poor soul on the side, you know, having to be involved, you know. The whole conversation has to be stopped for conversations. Actually, I was at a birthday dinner 2 days ago. It was my wife's aunt. It was her 70th birthday, and there were like 18 people around the table, most of whom I didn't right. know. And intermittently, my wife would stop and explain the conversation that was going, and all 18 people would stop and listen to her explain to me.
Wow.
So it's I'm outside of my comfort zone, but I've learned to embrace the being outside your comfort zone, because, you know, it's an opportunity to grow. And, you know, it's on me at the end of the day to learn the language. At the end of the day, it's just a language. And how many other people speak multiple different languages? I think as an English speaker first, you get comfortable and it's more difficult for us to kind of branch out. That's my excuse anyway, but it's that's on my on the top of my personal goals list this year, is to to throw myself into French a bit more and become fluent, as fluent as possible within a year.
That's amazing. So when you switched over from stockbroking to design, you were in Australia.
Yes.
Were you in Australia by then?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. And then did your parents move to Australia too?
Nope. I was on.
So was it a phone call? Did you talk to your mom? Yeah. Your mom on the phone?
Yeah. This is before Zoom. Boy. This is. Yeah. This is all of that. And I can tell, like, the Asian background, like the connection they have with their parents and the decisions they make and the impact of that on the relationship. I can tell from your question. Your questions, dude. That would have been a big one, but no, like I've got my parents are very, very working class, just kind of making our way in the world, and working hard was their benchmark, and any success after that was kind of a bonus. So yeah, as I said, quite humble beginnings.
I love that. So you've been doing Brand Master Academy for a while now. How many years has it been, Stephen?
Brand Master Academy, 2019. So I'm in the fifth year now, at the moment. And that was another big risk. It was another big jump, because to create Brand Master Secrets, that was 6 months of 12 wow. to 14 hour days. Researching, writing, recording, editing.
Right.
And that's just to produce the program. After that, you have the branding and the website and the everything that goes with it for your own brand, the marketing strategy and getting that off the ground. So I kind of went all in on something that I believed I knew there was a market for it, because I just knew it, because from the conversations that I had and knowing how little information there was on brand strategy out there in the market, I was just like, all right, you know, if I could create something that I didn't have that I wish I had, would I buy that? And I was like, absolutely. So there was a bit of blind faith in what I was doing. I'd love to tell you that I hired a market research firm and got them to produce a document that confirmed to me that this was going to work. But that wasn't the case.
Right.
But yeah, it's been 4 or 5 years now since Brand Master Academy has been launched. We just hit 100,000 subscribers on YouTube a couple of months ago.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you very much. So it's been a great journey. The podcast has been great, getting to rub shoulders with some of my heroes, Marty Neumeier. Wow. Like when I got into design and that led me to branding, I started asking all these questions, like, why are we doing this? Why should we do this? What's the strategy behind this? Who are we trying to connect with? Like, and it was just an organic curiosity thing. And that led me to the term brand strategy. That led me to Marty Neumeier and to his book, The Brand Gap. And I was hooked. So being able to interview him on the Brand Master podcast was definitely a highlight, along with so many other great guests, on the show. As I said, it's something that's been very rewarding for me. It's a very enjoyable journey that I've been on.
It does seem like scratching your own itch is often, or solving your own problem, right? It's often a great way to get started. And that's obviously what you did, because, like you said, going from a designer climbing upstream to strategy, like what resources are there for me? So you created something on your own. A question for you, Stephen, like when you started, did you have an audience like you have today? Probably not, right? Like what, how were you thinking about like audience building and all that?
Yeah, it's a very, very good question, because when I often forget, because I've got such a great base of followers, like really, I've got an email list of 35,000, and I cull that list, religiously. When I say I cull that list, if you haven't opened one of my emails in the last couple of weeks, and you've only been on there 30 days, you're off the list.
You're out.
If you haven't opened an email and you've been on my list 90 days, and you haven't opened an email in the last month, you're out. So, you know, I've taken, probably 60,000 people off my list, which is why I have open rates of 45 to 50%. So when I send an email out, half the people, and you know, anybody who knows anything about open rates on email, right. That's a good target. So no, I didn't have a base to open from. And I threw myself into a 30-day challenge for YouTube. And I talk about a 30-day challenge or a 90-day challenge with students all the time. If they're doing anything new, 30-day challenge. And it was create 30 videos in 30 days. And by the 30th video, not only will you be better on camera, but you'll have your processes down. And that will give you the launch pad that you need to gain that momentum. So, you know, putting out 30 videos on YouTube and, you know, only having a few views, how did I keep that faith? I don't know. I really don't know. I followed a guy who ended up being a mentor for quite a while called Miles Beckler. Miles talks a lot about marketing strategy and he's a really great guy. He had built a YouTube subscriber base, and he said to me, "Look, the stuff that you talk about is great. 30-day challenges, it will definitely throw you out there." Another very good connection that I made along the way, who is still a great connection today, and I consider him a friend as well, as Jacob Cass. Jacob, I had followed for many, many years on his blog. And his face just kept popping up with everything that I researched. So he randomly reached out to me just on the cusp of me launching Brandmaster Academy. He reached out to me, and he reached out to me to ask me if he could republish something that I had posted on a brand archetypes article. And that just opened up the conversation of, listen, I've got something for you. I want you to kind of test this out and let me know what your thoughts are, because you have
amazing
this experience. And he was like, I absolutely love this. And I'm like, okay, would you like to share it out to your audience? He was like, absolutely. So that gave me another push into the market. So yeah, the growth then was organic, and in the first year, the interest and the demand for the content was absolutely huge. You know, since then, people are talking about brand strategy a lot more. It's not so new now, there are still a lot of people who just dance around the periphery and really want to get to the center point. So for anyone starting out and they don't have an audience, I definitely recommend that 30-day challenge. And making the right connections as well. Just be bold and brave and just reach out to a ton of people who share the same audience with you, and, you know, ask them if you can do something for them, give them a test of your product. What do you think of this? Just start a relationship, and then you don't know where that's going to go. I have this analogy of, I love to open doors if it's free. So if it doesn't take much to open a door, just open it, because you don't know what's behind that door. Now, you might open 99 doors and there's nothing behind it, just a dark room. You might open another door and there are 5 golden doors behind that door, and you don't know where they're going to take you. So if it's free, open the door.
I love that. And I can't say that enough about reaching out and And you never know. You never know what happens.
Yeah,
right?
it's the same kind of deal. It's like you reaching out to myself, and I can see your profile growing, and I can see you making those connections with other people. And all that is really is just opening the door. It's free.
Right. Right.
That's it.
Right. Yeah. And you never know.
You never know who's behind it.
Yeah. I love that so much. So one of the things I'm really itching to ask you about, because you have a podcast, you've been doing this for a while. What are some trends and debates in the world of brand strategy that you see today that you're excited to talk about, or something that rubs you the wrong way? Like, what do you see right now out there?
Yeah, look, one of the big things is this idea. There are a couple of things. I mean, the obvious thing is the education gap that we as brand strategists and brand strategy professionals, we need to close. And that is the idea that branding is this visual thing. And I've got a few theories as to why that's, you don't have loads of people going out there into the world and going, branding is just a logo. You don't, but you do have a lot of people making those assumptions and over-investing in the visuals and under-investing in the strategy. And I think our job as professionals is to help our clients. I know a lot of people, they believe that when they put together a brand strategy offer, they have to find people who are ready to buy or invest in brand strategy. And I don't believe that's the case. I believe you need to educate your audience into being in a position where they're ready to invest in what you have to offer. If you look at any market, only about 3% of the market is ready to buy at this given time. 97% of the market is not ready to buy. So if you buy into that philosophy and you say, okay, well, I'm going to put my focus on the 97% or even, the 20% that are way out on the periphery, and I'm going to put on the board that they're going to be ready to invest in brand strategy in a year's time. And between now and then, I'm going to educate the hell out of them so that when they decide that they want to invest in their brand, they're going to do it in the right way. So closing the education gap on what branding is really about and helping your clients and your audience get to the center point of where decisions are made. I'm talking buying decisions here. How we can influence the audience. That's the center point of everything we do as brand builders. It's not about the visuals. It's psychology. We're talking about people here, people who have problems, and behind those problems, they have human emotions and they have frustrations. They also have desires and aspirations. These are all very, very potent things if you know how to hook into them. And helping audiences, helping your clients to connect with that, because they know that on a subconscious level. They just haven't had anybody articulate it to them in a way that's valuable enough to them so that they say, I need a brand strategy. So if you are offering brand strategy service and you find yourself with the challenge of, I can't find anybody who values brand strategy services, then you say to yourself, okay, well, it's my job to make sure that they do value brand strategy services, and I'm going to educate them towards that point. And then I'll prime them to want my offering. Another point that I was going to make about brand strategy, I car parked it just as I was about to make that point. But I can't remember it. If I remember it, I'll come back to it. But I can't remember.
Stephen, a hypothesis I have, maybe around this idea of why people feel brand strategy is all about visuals, is that brand strategy is typically invisible. Nobody sees it, right? Right.
So
people see the outcome.
Yes.
The result.
You've brought me back to my other point, and that's the idea of branding ROI. Okay. So Another challenge that we have in convincing our clients is that we're going to have something tangible to give them that if they invest in this brand strategy, they're going to get X, Y, and Z. And mm-hmm. what business owners are typically used to now, because they've been absolutely spoiled since digital marketing has come about, are metrics. Metrics that are available for absolutely everything, whether that's your mm-hmm. Your traffic, your conversions, your click-through rate, whatever it may be. Like, you've got metrics coming out of your ears, and you know, you can get addicted to metrics. Business owners are getting addicted to metrics, and you know, they're focusing so much on tactics and things that they say move the needle in the business, but branding ROI is indirect. Okay, so you know, when you go to Facebook ads and you're chasing a return on interest and you're chasing those metrics, you know, if you don't have your ducks in a row before you go to market, your marketing is going to be expensive. You know, mm-hmm. the cost per click, the cost per conversion, the cost per right. acquisition. These are all metrics that are tangible. But if your ducks are in a row with your brand and your brand strategy, now when I talk about ducks in a row with your brand and your brand strategy, you know crystal clear exactly who your audience is. And you can define them by articulating exactly who your audience is not. Now, when I'm talking about exactly who your audience is not, I'm not talking about, you know, other markets. I'm talking about the very people within the exact market that you're targeting. There are a group of people who you are not targeting. And if you can get right. if you can get clear on who those are, you're more clear on who your audience is. So, you know, knowing who your audience is, you know, that's the starting point, because then you can find out who your competitors are. You can find out what exactly they're offering your shared audience. And then you can figure out what do they like about what they're offering? What do they not like? What do they want more of? What do they want less of? And you can find your gap in the market. You can find a way to speak very, very specifically to that group of people. And there's a term that I don't speak enough about, but it's super important. It's relevance. The more relevant you can be to a given audience, and when I talk about relevance, I'm talking about how are you going to be able to resonate with them in a way that your competitors aren't? So, for example, you know, if I was to create a design business and I have a background in accounting, then it might make sense for me to provide services specifically to accounting businesses, or, you know, businesses in and around that area, because I understand the journey that they're going on and the challenges that they have, and I can be more relevant to them in the way they speak. That's just one example, but relevance is really, really important. If you have your ducks in a row about who your audience is and a way to resonate with them by being more relevant, then when you go to the game of strategy and the game of positioning, you're able to define a real meaning to give your audience to choose you over the rest. And that center mm-hmm. point of positioning is everything. Everything flows from there. You know, what you talk about, the problems you talk about, the way you frame those problems, the stories that you tell. So if you have all of your ducks in a row when it comes to your brand strategy, when you go to market, when you go to Facebook ads, whether you're engaging a professional to do that or you're doing it yourself, having that insight and that deep understanding of who your audience is and the challenges and the emotions that they have, and learning how to frame that in your marketing, you know, how less expensive is your marketing going to be? It's going to be significantly cheaper, because your messages are going to resonate with the people in their feeds. That's going to tell the algorithm, this brand gets this audience. Right. It's going to be cheaper then. Your click-through rates is going to be cheaper. Your cost per lead is going to be cheaper. Your cost per acquisition, it's going to be cheaper. Can you attribute that back to branding and brand strategy and a clearly articulated position? No, it's indirect. It's indirect. However, if you do have that versus if you don't have that, you are going to see significantly different metrics on the front lines. And at the end of the day, the clarity that you get from having your ducks in a row when it comes to your brand strategy, that's just internal, you know? The metrics are on the outside, but the believability that a leader has in their own brand of where they're going when they really understand who their audience is, mm-hmm. what their position is, and what they mean in the market, you know, that's priceless because, you know, they show up for that brand every day through a sense of belief, you know, and they give everything. Yeah. So there's the internal clarity and the external clarity that we get. But branding ROI, that's a big thing. It's very hard to articulate because, you know, they're all chasing metrics. But when you know how to articulate the indirect nature of the clarity of brand strategy, both internally and externally, that's when you can sell the value of it.
Yeah. No, I fully agree. I think it is up to brand practitioners to educate and bring, you know, their clients along. I think what's super interesting is, you know, some of the debates, even among brand practitioners, you know, I can think of a couple of things. Like one is, you know, last year, quite a lot of disasters around bringing in purpose or inclusion or, you know, diversity into their marketing and quite a lot of big fails, right? So there are brand practitioners that say, oh, you ought to do this or you ought to do that. What are some of your thoughts around that topic?
Do you believe that the best things in life are free? Well, good. I've just released 6 different guides and blueprints that compiles my years of building brands in healthcare. And they've taken me over 100 hours to create. And they are now absolutely free for you to download. You don't even have to enter your email. Just go to healthybrandconsulting.com/free resources. And it's healthybrandconsulting.com/free resources. Enjoy. Now back to our episode.
Steven. Look, on a kind of long-term trajectory, the evolution of brands fascinates me. They've become a human entity. Okay, so they've gone from this corporate entity. Remember, branding was always taught as a subset of marketing, this little thing. It's evolved into this, not just this overarching discipline, but this overarching entity that is becoming a human entity. When you think about a brand, you think about things like purpose, vision, mission, values, you know, a personality, a verbal identity, a style. These are all inherently human attributes.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're seeing is these human attributes being instilled in brands. So essentially, they're evolving into these human entities. And what I also see happening as well is that since the introduction of social media and that two-way dialogue, because remember, back in the 90s, brands didn't really have to answer to anybody because there was no collective voice. And then people, of course, you had, you had boycotts and picketing and stuff like that. But that only went so far. You couldn't get a viral, picketing event. But, you know, since the dawn of social media, that's changed because there's a collective voice. And then people have to start, the brands, they have to start to listen to that collective voice because that runs, that virality became a very, very dangerous thing for brands. So the verbal identity and the way brands spoke and the dialogue, that's all an organic evolution that brands have had. But what I see now happening is that brands have started to become representatives of the people. What I mean by that is, you know, religion for a long time was a representation of the people. Politicians, you know, they're supposed to be representatives of the people, but we're being left with these choices that we're disconnected from now. You know, people have disconnected a lot from religion now, and they're getting more and more disconnected to, the idea of democracy because, you know, it's a you know, it's a rigged game, and the outcome is you know, it's a choice between two evils. So I think the more and more brands are, what brands are becoming is representatives of the people, because, you know, they attract similar people, you know,
right.
And if they understand those people, again, brand strategy 101, and they understand their beliefs, then they're like, okay, well, these people, they tend to all believe these things. And just so funnily enough, so do we. So we start talking, we start talking about that. And then, you know, especially the further up the chain you go in terms of the size of these brands, and we've seen it with the likes of Nike, with the Colin Kaepernick campaign, you know, they become representatives of the people, and people start to buy because, you know, there's an aligned belief system there. Now, I think this is an organic evolution that's happening, and I think we're still very early in this evolution. You know, and I think some brands are seeing it as a trend, and they're jumping into it for the wrong reasons. So there's also this, you know, there's this split in terms of, and that's why the term brand authenticity has come about. You know, is a brand really authentic in what they're saying? Do they really believe what we believe? Or are they just saying what we want to hear to get our money? Right. So there's a fine line to be had here. And I think it's a choice. It's a brand leadership choice. Do we want to play this game? Do we want to go down this road? Or should we just focus on the value that we're bringing to the table and make it all about the value? So look, brand purpose is not for every single brand. You have to be very careful if you start to talk about a purpose, you know, that you're not, you know, that you're not being hypothetical somewhere else, or hypocritical somewhere else, you know, and that happens quite a bit. So again, like anything, because brands are becoming human, then the leaders behind this human brand need to ask themselves, you know, is this really what we believe? You know, because if it's not, just like any human, if we're going to go out into the world and go, we believe this, and inside we're like, we don't really believe that, eventually the wheels are going to come off. Do you know what I mean?
That's right.
So that's right. I think just being connected with the human aspect of that, in answering those questions is very important.
Dude, that is 100% how I see it too, Stephen. Mm-hmm. You know, if you think about brand thinking, it's human thinking, mm-hmm. right? And this whole idea with alignment, what's inside needs to match the outside, what's outside needs to match the inside. That's a human thing, mm-hmm. right? It's kind of like so much of our lives, you know, we talk about the whole journey, you know, before we started this conversation about brand, is to understand what do you actually want to be? Who are you actually, mm-hmm. right? That's self-awareness. I think like any corporate brand, you also need to start with that self-awareness.
Yeah.
Who are you, right?
Absolutely.
Who are you at the core? Mm. No, I think that's absolutely right. The other thing, Stephen, is you are a brand master. You have a lot of people asking you questions, right? You have a Facebook group. Like there's a lot of people asking you stuff. Have there been some really interesting and thought-provoking questions that you've come across throughout these years?
Probably a million. You know, you've just asked me some very interesting, thought-provoking questions just before. But the you know, in terms of the thought provocation, where I really get juiced up is the psychology behind what we do. So I don't know if everybody's the same. I think generally we all have an inherent interest in why we do what we do. You know, what's behind our decisions, the human psychology behind our decisions. Of course, we're all interested in different ways. But yeah, the to the level that you're interested might be different to the level that I'm interested, because, you know, we all pick up different books at the end of the day. But, you know, I've got a real interest in humans, you know, why we do what we do, especially when you get to the, you know, to you know, connecting with people on a deeper level. You know, that you know, so questions in and around, you know, look, what are we doing at the end of the day? Why are we doing what we're doing? You know, they're the ones that kind of juice me up more than, you know, what's the structure of this brand, or how do I create a, you know, how do I create a positioning strategy? You know, they're all very important, but the thought-provoking questions are, you know, really in and around the human psychology for me.
What are some things that you think companies and people most get wrong about brand?
There is generally a massive education gap when it comes to brand. So when you ask, what do most people get wrong about brand? I would say most people get quite a bit wrong about brand. And it's scary how wrong. You've got very, very senior CMOs at big businesses, and their idea of brand, or their understanding of you know, the importance of you know, market segmentation, you know, targeting and positioning, and you know, there really is a big education gap, and for me, I don't know why it's taken so long for traditional education institutions to close that gap. I don't know why. I'm really baffled by it, because, you know, you will see big institutions, they have their marketing, they have their marketing degrees that they bring people through, and so little of it is about brand. They don't have branding degrees. They don't have brand strategy degrees. And, you know, we've come to this place where, you know, it's evolved before our eyes, yet the traditional education road has not kind of taken a detour and gone, okay, well, we can see there's an evolution here. Let's teach this in a different way. I think another part of the problem was, in fact, the dawn of the internet and the ability for people to start freelancing online, because we're in a very, very splintered industry. It's so splintered. You know, we have, you know, we have experts in so many different fields that are intertwined. You know, we have social media experts, social media strategists. We have copywriters. We have direct response marketers. You know, we have SEO specialists and content writers. You know, we have marketing strategists and marketing specialists. We have funnel specialists. You know, and all of these specialists, they all try to achieve ultimately the same goal, you know, and they all have their different perspectives on what way to do that. And they all, in their own way, at some stage, talk about brand. And they do it from, you know, from what I call the outside looking in. So for me, the center point is brand. The center point of the brand is the strategy. The center point of the strategy is the position. And on the outskirts, you have all of these different disciplines that we use to communicate the brand, okay? So the marketing strategy looks at all the different channels and all the different ways that we can engage the audience. You know, social media specialists, they look at how we can best utilize social media to bring people in. SEO or content writers, they do that from that perspective, and they're all on the periphery. And what's happening more and more is these tacticians on the periphery, they're starting to ask more questions about why are we doing this? And a lot of the time they're asking those questions because the consumer is getting more educated. They're reading more and they're starting to understand that they have a brand. And although they might need social media services or SEO services, you know, if they don't have an answer to the question of who is your brand, you know, what is your position, what is your meaning to the market, who is your target audience and why are you different for your competitors, what's your personality and your verbal identity, what's your messaging strategy and your storytelling strategy, if you don't have answers to those questions, then all of these peripheral disciplines, they're going to be misinformed. So so the way I see it is that the outside tacticians are starting to look inwards now and starting to ask the bigger brand questions. And as I said, you know, they all need to come back to the same place and get crystal clear on that target audience, why they're different from their competitors and what their position is, and learn then how to bring that to the outside market. So, it's another way that I see brand evolving in the coming years, is more and more tacticians getting curious about brand, either through their own, off their own back, or because their audience is more educated now. They're starting to understand that brand is more than just the logo and the visuals, and they need a bit of substance behind the questions that they're answering.
But you're so right, though. As soon as you start asking questions, it leads you upstream. As soon as you go upstream and there's no foundation in place, then you realize, uh-oh, there's a problem. Mm-hmm. Stephen, one of my most viral posts on LinkedIn was that I put a visual, just like kind of what you said, where it used to be people think branding is just a subset of marketing. But now, from my view, kind of same as yours, it's everything. It's literally everything, and it should be. And it caused quite a stir. Like, some people were like super upset by it. Like, no, there's no way this has happened.
And that's the thing. And I find the people who get upset by it are those who took the traditional route of marketing education, who were taught that branding is a subset of marketing and marketing is the overarching discipline. And they're defending that position with their lives. And look, I get it, you know. That's their baby. That's where they're for. They want to, but that's perfectly fine. But if you can't answer the question of, has branding evolved outside of its traditional marketing subset? If you're answering no to that question, then you're holding on to something, and there's a bit of denial involved. Because look, diversity inclusion is not something that we ever spoke about when it comes to marketing, but branding. Okay, so if that's true for diversity inclusion, is it possible that there are other verticals within the business that are related to the brand, but they're not related to marketing? Maybe.
Yeah, it's so true. I think as soon as you open your eyes and you start seeing, you know, what are the impacts, what's actually happening out in the marketplace, and then you'll quickly realize, like we talked about, it's a human thing. It's not a marketing or a PR or a, you know, tactical functional thing. It's not. It's about interacting with people. Right. Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's it. And that's how we connect. That's how we connect as people. Like, even if you think about it, you think about the things that we're emotionally connected to. You've got you've got pets, for example. You've got inanimate objects like cars. And when you talk about the things that you like about those things, you relate back to human characteristics. Mm-hmm. You know, I like this dog because he's this way. I mean, you think about how many times you've seen a dog and their owner looks exactly like the dog. You know, it's because the owner likes these certain characteristics and they go for those certain characteristics.
That's amazing.
The same with, and cars are the same, you know. People want their cars to be a representation of who they are. You might see a guy who's big and burly and he's got a big and burly car, or you might see someone who's more feminine and petite and they have a Fiat 500 just nipping about the place. So, you know, we are attracted to human characteristics, and the more human we're able to make, our engagement with our audience and what we do and what we offer, the more likely we are to resonate with who they
are. Right. I mean, this is the magic mirror, isn't it? It's you want to be with, you know, the same as who you like to become. You want to see yourself in the things that you associate with.
That's it. And I think the magic mirror is a great idea when it comes to brands, because it encapsulates so much of what we're talking about. You know, you say magic mirror, you know, and you're talking about a reflection. And that's what brands are, really. They're a reflection of the person. And the more reflective they are of the person, the more likely they are to resonate with who they are. So, yeah, I think the human aspect of what we do is so overlooked. You know, it's becoming more prevalent now, but it's something that really juices me up, and it's something that I love about what we do.
Yeah. Let me get your perspective. So most of what I do is working with brands in the world of healthcare and brands that impact health. So if you think about that world and in that industry, what would you say are some opportunities? You know, what are some things that companies and brands in the world of health could be doing, but you know, you would like to see more of?
Yeah, look, I mean, specifically in the health industry, and I suppose, look, this is not specifically for the health industry, but it would work very well, and it does work very well in the health industry. But this is applicable to any other industry. It's a case of looking at your market and going, okay, what can I do differently? Like, what's the, you know, what's the status quo for this space? And what's the opposite of that? You know, I love to play devil's advocate, not just with branding, but with conversation as well, just on any given topic. What's the opposite of what we're talking about? Like, if we have an opinion on something, what's the opposite of that? So, for example, looking into the healthcare space, it's a very, very serious industry. And I get it. You know, health is a serious topic, and we can find ourselves having conversations about things that we don't necessarily want to be having. And the thing about health is that, you know, it only really kind of arrives as an issue when there is an issue at hand. Unfortunately, but there's a great quote by someone, I don't know who it is, but it's you know, those who don't make the time for good health will eventually have to make the time for bad health, or something like that. I definitely butchered that, but it's a very, very good quote. But the point that I'm making is that it is a very, very serious topic. Yeah, going back to the idea of what can we do differently, there's a lot to be said for humor in the healthcare industry. There's actually a brand that I really like the look of. I haven't dug too deep into them, but it's a UK brand called Newman.com. Mm. So now they talk about men's health issues. So, you know, stuff that men don't like to talk about or never talk about, you know, all of that stuff got to do with all of this up here and all of that down there. We're talking like about erectile dysfunction and all of that really, really sensitive stuff when it comes to men. And, you know, they've put a humorous spin on it. They've got this like real G.I. Joe, you know, and it's done in the kind of Wallace and Gromit animated style. And he's just got this really funny sense of humor about him, but he's this big macho man. And he drops in on these situations where men are having these erectile dysfunction incidents, or their hair is falling out in, you know, and they put a funny and positive spin on the end of it, and then there's a call to action of, get your free blood test. If there's nothing wrong, you get your money back or something like that. But the way that's so refreshing is, you know, in an industry that's so serious, it got my attention. Mm-hmm. You know, now I'm interested in brands. I'm interested in brands, what brands do. So I know that it's going to take my attention a little bit more. But anyone in the industry, or you think about the target audience, anybody having any kind of problem like that, they don't talk about it and they see this big butch funny guy making light of it and then giving them a call to action. It just takes the seriousness away from it, and it makes the person go, why not? You know? So I think there's a lot to be said for humor in not just the health industry, but any serious industry. Just going against the grain, leaving the corporateness behind. You know, this idea that we have to be kind of 80s corporate tie up, for the most part, none of us like that form of communication, even if we're after, you know, an accountant or, a lawyer. Sometimes it's okay just to add a little human element to what's going on. There's big opportunities there for brands that are a bit ballsy and, you know, embrace kind of going against the grain. We talk so much about standing out, mm-hmm. and, you know, it's become such a cliche now, but it does take some balls to make those decisions.
Absolutely does.
And, you know, if you can, you know, sprinkle a bit of that into your decision-making process when it comes to your positioning, and you have bold people behind you kind of facilitating that, then, you know, there are opportunities for health brands there.
Yeah, no, I think that's so right. And we always talk about this, like you said, standing out, how can we be different? And then, you know, mm-hmm. in the end, it's still about are you really aligned to the core of who you are? If you say that you're this type of company, this is what you stand for, go stand for it. Mm. Go stand for it.
Yeah.
Right? And that means making absolutely. A hard decision.
And look, not every brand has to be disruptive. You know, there's you can be offering the exact same, like Newman.com, for example. They offer, you know, blood tests, and they offer, supplements, and they offer, how many other companies do that? They offer the exact same thing, right. But they have brought some personality to the table, and the way they're delivering the message is so important. You know, they of course they've got they probably have a very streamlined e-commerce platform to kind of go with it to make it very, very easy. But on the face of it, just like Old Spice, when they changed up their personality as well. So much can be said for kind of going against the grain of your industry when it comes to your personality and how you speak to them, mm-hmm. and, you know, just being a bit ballsy in in that decision-making process.
Steven, if you think back to whether it's you working as a brand strategist or working with the client, can you give us a story of when something didn't go quite as planned, or, you know, some story of where you learned the most from? Like, was there ever a time where you got kind of dicey or iffy, or?
Yeah, look, I've learned many, many lessons along the way, and the lessons that you learn from most tend to be the mistakes, you know. And the ones that stand out the most are, where projects didn't end so well. You kind of left with a bad taste in your mouth, and that it brings up the idea of, it brings up the question, what didn't I do right? Mm-hmm. You know, because if something hasn't ended well,
yeah,
and you're the vendor, it's most likely on you. You know, now if things don't end well, but you have your ducks in a row and you usher them out the door in the right way, then, you know, kudos to you for having your processes in a row and knowing your boundaries. And I think that's a big part of what we do as professionals.
Is there a specific incident you can think of, Steven, that you could share? Bring us back to the moment. Bring yourself back to the moment. Or is it too traumatic?
No. So I remember I was I I was working with this client who, from the very start, did you ever look? We've all got our personalities, and we've all got these little chinks in our armor where we're like, you know, I don't like that side about me, you know. And for me, it's I used to be way worse than this than I am today. Sometimes I could be quite cutting in the way I spoke to people. I had a habit, especially if I was outside my comfort zone, of talking down to people, and I used it as a kind of armor. So sometimes you meet people and you see that very trait that you have in yourself, and you're like, am I like that? You know. So this client was like that, you know, the way he spoke from the very start, in the discovery call, you know, in the preliminary meetings. And then I ignored the red flags. I didn't have processes in place. And I went down the road of going through this, even the revisions. This was, something that I didn't have in my processes. I did have in my processes, but not clear enough, not articulate enough as to what the revisions were supposed to be. So as soon as I got into that project, he started to treat me like an employee, and the tone in which he spoke to me, it was disrespectful. Now I didn't call him out on anything, because, you know, we were there with his team in those boardroom meetings, and he would speak to me, and I saw him speaking to other people in the same way as well. I really didn't like it. But it kind of escalated when the changes became overwhelming in terms of, you know, we need to do this, we need to do that. He had access to what was going on relatively live. So the changes would be coming through. Those emails turned into texts, and those texts turned into phone calls. And I remember sitting in my, I'd come home from the office. I was sitting in my garage. I had just answered the call as I was pulling into my house. And I sat in the garage on my phone for about 30 or so minutes. I knew my dinner was on the table upstairs because I was due to walk in the door. The way this guy was speaking to me, and I had just had enough, and I just said, Stuart, I really don't appreciate the way that you're speaking to me at the moment. I think we need to take a time out here. I think just before that, I said to him, look, I understand where you're coming from. Like, I empathize. And he said, I don't want your empathy. So from that point, I didn't answer another call. I didn't answer another text. I streamlined everything through email. I responded intermittently in group emails. I tried to impose some restrictions around him, but it was too late. The genie was out of the bottle on that one. And I just got the job done as quickly as I could. And I moved on from that. We were both happy to see the back of each other. But I remember saying to myself after that, I am never going to work with someone like that again. I updated my processes, my terms of service, to make sure that it was crystal clear in terms of how we would communicate, the conditions under which we would communicate. And that's a big one that I learned from. I've told that story before because, yeah, it was sitting in the car park and him speaking to me like I was a child. I don't want your empathy. It was just like, I'm an adult, man. Don't speak to me like that.
Wow.
But I think, and this is very, very true from my experience anyway. There is this, and especially if you come across that type of personality. However anybody grew up in their family, however they were spoken to by their parents, you know, that's on them. But when you're in an adult arena with other adults, there's a way to conduct yourself. But I do have this belief that when somebody pays you money, and there is a transaction involved, all of a sudden you become their subordinate and the dynamics of the conversation changes. And there, now, not everybody is like this. There are a lot of respectful people, and I've had a lot of beautiful clients, and you know, we're a team. But you set that standard from the very beginning, mm-hmm. and you make sure that you're on a level with them. But yeah, I do feel that there are a certain segment of any given market when they hand over money, they believe you're their subordinate, and they can speak to you however they want.
Dude, like, that's such a good story. Because I think, like you said, the Spidey sense at the beginning should have listened to that. I mean, that's a huge signal. That's a huge mm-hmm. signal. And I think, you know, for me too, you know, working with clients, it's number one thing. There has to be a connection. There has to be this, like, all right, you know, we can work together. The human part mm-hmm. is so important.
Yeah, and I think you can nip a lot of things in the bud. By sending across your terms of service, right. And then, you know, if you do have your spidey senses and you do feel that there's somebody like that, you know, you can just jump on a call with them and just say, I just want to make sure that you had a read through the terms of service. Look, for me, at the end of the day, respect is the number one thing. We're a team in this. We're going to get the most if we're together as a team. And, you know, if you feel some pushback there, that's your opportunity to just say, look, I don't think we're the right fit for each other. But for the most part, addressing it early on, they'll just fall into line and go, oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I feel that if I had done that with this client early on, either it would have given me the opportunity to go the other way, or he just would have fallen into line and been more respectful from the very beginning. I think if you set your boundaries out from the very beginning, people respect them for the most part.
Steven, it's an absolute pleasure chatting with you. But before I let you go, I have three questions for you. So the first one, we're strategists, right? And we love insights. That's what we do. We hunt mm-hmm. for insights. We uncover them. If you think about your career, your journey you've had so far, what has been an insight and aha in your life that you really sort of hung on to? What is that for you?
Yeah, I think, I've spoken about this before, mm-hmm. I think it kind of came back as well. I when I spoke before about when people, pay you money, the dynamic changes. And I also think there is an idea, certainly with inexperienced experts, inexperienced professionals, that they have the answers and they have the keys and you need to follow them because they know everything. I think we all need a little bit more humility in everything that we're doing in the professional world, generally in life. But a book that I read by Gary Vee, actually, called The Thank You Economy, I picked it up at the right time. I picked it up at the right time when I was when I was transitioning from visual identity design to strategy. Mm. And I was coming from the point of view of, you don't need a logo, you need a strategy, and I'm going to tell you what to do and you're going to come with me. And, you know, after many, many, many rejections, on discovery calls, I just happened to read this book in that moment, and the idea of humility and gratitude, and being there for your client. At the end of the day, every brand exists. Mm. To serve their client. If that client doesn't exist, if those customers don't exist, there is no reason for the brand to exist. So just living by that philosophy, really helped me in the way I dealt with clients, the way I dealt with people. And I still do that. I still embrace that to this day. Like, you probably do. You probably get more and more, but the inbox is a vortex. And although I do have a team that help me out, I'm insistent still on responding to personal emails. And some of them And, you know, this certainly is to my detriment. Some of them, you know, I write responses that big, you know, because I just get sucked into, because the question comes from a really kind of deep place of, you know, I need some guidance. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I get you, man. I get you. And you know, this is what you need to do. You know, don't be too hard on yourself. Take the time. And you know, some of my responses are this big. And although I have templated some responses, mm-hmm. You know, like for those personal emails, I still like to take the time. And that comes from this place of gratitude and just being happy to be part of their journey. So yeah, just a little bit more humility in the things that we do, understanding that there's a human on the other side, and, you know, embracing that gratitude.
That's phenomenal. Second question for you. If you could go back in time and talk to Steven at the beginning of his career, and you can define this time point as when, you know, is your beginning, what would you say? What would you say to Steven?
Of course you can say, don't worry, everything's going to work out in the end. I think something that I learned to do along the way was to put myself outside my comfort zone to embrace failure. Mm-hmm. Because I've read a lot of books. I really have read a lot of books. I've done a lot of programs. I've got a lot of experience. But the mistakes that I made, and what they did for me, they were the biggest lessons of all. I talk about I've told this story many times, and I know we're late in the show at the moment, so I'll keep it pretty short. But I in my stockbroking days, I had to go into a new company, and they were using a new software, and I didn't know it, and I had stockbrokers calling out orders, and I was messing up the orders, and like, you had to have a license to do what I did because you were on the front lines of the market. If you hit a wrong figure, you could clean out the whole market. Like, let's say, you know, Apple stock. If you hit the wrong number, you could clear it all out. And then you would be up for that amount. So I was making mistakes. I lost my company thousands of dollars. And I wanted to quit. I didn't want to come in. I had sweaty palms every day coming into work. I kept my head down in case somebody wanted to ask for an order. I hated my life for weeks. But slowly I started to kind of gain traction. I didn't quit. I didn't quit. That was the big thing. I stuck with it. You know, if they were going to fire me, they were going to fire me, but I wasn't going to quit. And eventually I became, you know, a respected trader in that office, and I got through it. But the resilience that gave me, you know, to not be afraid of mistakes, to not shy away from it, and to not quit, that stayed with me. So put yourself outside your comfort zone and push through it.
That's such great advice. Last one for you. What makes a brand healthy?
Oh. Curious leaders who are obsessed about their customers.
Wow.
If you're obsessed about your customer, then you're going to want to know everything about them, especially in the realm of what you do for them. Of course, you can talk about the car they drive and, you know, their demographics and their psychographics. But no, when you get really to the core of the journey they're on, before they even know they have the problem that you're going to solve, to figuring out what that problem is, to figuring out the solutions that they have, to understanding their challenges as they go along, to understanding, you know, the potential consequences of not fixing that problem, the desires of what they're going to get when they come out the other side of that. And then being curious about how you can build your brand around every aspect of that. Yeah, that's what makes a healthy brand.
Steven, thank you so much for being on the show. It's been really fun. It's been tremendous.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Howie. I'm watching on with interest and curiosity as your stock grows, and I'll look forward to speaking with you in the future.
Thank you, mate. That was amazing. Steven is just such a gracious person, and I'm so thankful for his time and him sharing with us how he thinks about branding and life.
What's the status quo for this space? And what's the opposite of that?
Thank you for listening as always. And if you like this episode, share it with a friend, give it a 5-star review, write a comment. In the meantime, go build the healthiest brands on the planet. Take care.